This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 425 was produced on April 25th, 2024. I'm Eric Townsend. Hante Investments founder and CIO Alex Gurevich returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss whether inflation will be persistent, currencies, precious metals, energy markets, and more.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. The S&P 500 June futures were up 89 basis points, closing at 5107. The puzzle to solve, is this an oversold bounce or the start of another bull leg higher? We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch. In the post-game segment, the U.S. dollar index down 11 basis points, trading at 105.82. The June WTI crude oil contract down 10 basis points to 82.81, consolidating at its 50-day moving average. Will those supports hold? We'll take a look at that chart in the postgame, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. The June RBOB gasoline up 37 basis points, trading at 271. The June gold contract down 209 basis points, trading at 23.38. Finally, a pause and a correction in the advance. Copper up 276 basis points, trading at 446. Uranium down 151 basis points, trading at 88 even. And the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield up 7 basis points, trading at 465. The key news to watch this week is the Friday's core PCE price index. And next week, we have the ISM manufacturing and services PMIs, the FOMC press conference, and the jobs numbers. This week's feature interview guest is Hante Investment founder and CIO, Alex Gurevich. Eric's interview with Alex is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Alex Gurevich, founder and CIO at Hante Investments. Alex has prepared a slide deck to accompany today's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Click the red button above Alex's picture that says looking for the downloads. Alex, last time we had you on the show, you expressed a more disinflationary to deflationary view, somewhat out of consensus with a few of our other guests. Any change in that view? And what is your outlook in terms of inflation versus deflation looking forward?
Well, Eric, first, thank you for having me back. It's always good to have an ongoing discussion and kind of compare the views. Last time, several months ago, we had a little discussion about what Team Transitory got wrong. And I was trying to analyze what me being on Team Transitory, in which ways some things were correct, but which were fundamental errors. I don't want to repeat that, but I'm just saying it's kind of good to have those every several months check-ins and see, like, what happened? What were we wrong about? Not just I told you so's, but also what were we wrong about and how do we take in new information? I will say, compared to a few months ago, there were probably more challenges than confirmations, to my view, that I've been, however, not a huge change. And I will explain why the change is not huge, but I will, as a brief summary, I will say that the time is getting closer to the point that my view will be seriously challenged. So the timelines have to be moved a little further. And if the certain timelines will not be met in, I would say, half a year to a year, I will be under pressure to keep saying, yes, it's all going according to my big program. That's how I would summarize it. So the core of my view, behind deflationary view, was policy lag. And the fact that everything that happens with rates works with a huge lag. And the core of my position in the end of 2023 was that it is too early to say until second half of 2024. And that's when the timeline I pointed out back then, it's not the timeline I'm creating now, that until second half of 2024, it will be too hard to say what effect real rates could even have had yet. So what I see in the narrative so far, I see the disinflationary narrative to me is clear. I think the high inflation period is over. I see no like new inflation spiral or anything like this. I know that some people disagree with me, but I see no signs of that. I don't want to get worked up over inflation ticking down 0.1% as people were in 2023 or being like 0.05% higher than projected for a couple of months. That does not mean there is no like inflationary crisis going, but there is no deflationary bust going on. Also, as I wrote in my quarterly report to investors, it's currently hard to say that the economy is weak. You could squint to look for signs of economic weakness, but overall, the numbers were pretty solid this quarter. What I feel like there is a strong discrepancy. I'm just doing right now an overview to show how complex the landscape is. I feel majority of top-down numbers are fairly robust. You're seeing whatever like GDP type numbers, anything looking from the employment numbers, they'll look like any aggregate numbers look good. There are some bottom-up numbers that certain analysts point out certain areas of weakness, like restaurant occupancy or like amount of delinquencies or amount of bankruptcies. Somehow, or even new people showing the new rounds of layoffs, it's not so far filtering into top-down numbers. And since I'm not a bottom-up person, I really cannot speak to that. All I'm saying is that I'm seeing some serious disagreements between analysts. I am not a person who crunches original economic numbers. I'm a consumer of that research. And what I'm seeing is opposing pieces of research on what is the level of economic health. Now, inflation and rates and stock market and economic health, all of those things are not the same thing. They're related, but they're not the same thing. For example, we can see deflation and really low interest rates and robust stock market. We can see recession and stock market making new highs. Au contrary, we can see really weak stock market and really strong and hot running economy. All of those situations, which I think people had difficulty imagining a decade ago, are possible in the new regimes. In the regimes of fiscal dominance, in the regime of really aggressively reacting Fed. That's what I think blindsided a lot of people in 2020. The fact that while the economy was still weak, stock markets started to run up because the influx of cash was just so huge that the buying power was there. It was less challenging for me back then because I was already thinking about those things a lot by before the year 2020. Things like, why does stock market don't have to go down during a recession? Or does inflation have to go hot during growth period? Which people are trained to use interlinked. I actually just tended to be concurrent, but a lot of concurrencies are broken now. So we're navigating this complicated landscape. Now, my fundamental thesis is that the most important input for future inflation is current inflation. That inflation leads to more inflation leads to less inflation. Because there is a certain zone in which not much spiraling happening. And right now, I think we're at the moment in that zone of inflation. But fundamentally, if you said inflation was so high during COVID bump that it created this post-COVID wave, then we had a bull wave of coming off post-COVID when inflation came down and it led to a patch of low inflation. Now it bull whipped the more like normal post-COVID environment. And now the question is, will interest rates do this, their work to bring inflation down? Now, and my thesis is that higher real rates are deflationary because higher real rates force increase in productivity. Higher real rates cause people to be careful with their balance sheet, cause to draw down inventories, cause to be really careful with their money. And that's the opposite of inflationary. Furthermore, currently the yield on, say, something like 20, 30-year inflation index bonds, which, by the way, I think among the best assets out there right now, is close to 2.5%. Now, with that yield, how is it can be even wrong for people put a bond in their retirement account and inflation plus 2.5%? You're guaranteed for 30 or 40 years to make positive real yield. that's a too rich a proposition historically. I don't think those things are trading anywhere at the right level. I think they're catastrophically cheap. They're like default level cheap, the long day, this type of assets. I think real rates on treasury bonds should and will converge to zero in the long run. There will be periods of negative real rates and positive real rates on treasury bonds. But risk-free bonds, makes sense for me that they run roughly at inflation. So, which means that the real yield on TIPS should be close to zero. And right now they're way undervalued, especially in the long end. So that's kind of the big thing. Now, if you're okay with this, I'm going to move to some charts to see how I'm thinking about that.
Sure. I see you've got real rates on page 3.
This chart is not really a market chart. It does not prove anything. It's just an illustration, the chart that I'm showing there. And it's showing the average real rates. So the green line shows the average SOFR. So that was the policy rate over the period of 2 years. So it's a rolling 2-year average. And why am I talking about 2 years? Like those who have seen my previous presentations, I really believe in 2-year cycles and everything fits really well in 2-year cycles. Now, when I take an average rate over the last 2 years, I'm actually being generous. I'm not saying that things act with 2-year lag. I am saying that everything over the last 2 years matters for where things are today. And then the blue line is the 2-year average of monthly CPI. Now, you could say, why CPI? Why not core CPI? Why not PC? Fundamentally, the picture would be very similar. There will be, of course, squiggle would be less extreme or more extreme. I'm just choosing CPI. So I would be less kind of accused of doctoring my evidence, like the thing that is the headline, the thing that goes into the pricing of inflation bonds and so on. But you could choose your own thing to, when you do like actual trading and actual analysis, be more precise with it, choose your own things. I'm just giving a guideline here. What you see, the bar line, that the actual average or real rates over the last 2 years. Now, what you're seeing is that average was very negative over the last 4 years, like somewhere like in 2021 or late 2020, and that average became very negative by 2022. Now, one of the interesting things in 2022 is we had what looked like extreme tightening of financial conditions. We had sell-off, very bad sell-off on bonds, stronger dollar, and pretty serious, not like deepest, but legitimate grinding bear market on stocks for a few months. And there was a lot of inflation predictions. I was agnostic on inflation. My view was on deflation, which also didn't pan out right away, right? But there was a wave of disinflation in 2023. It was not as deep or severe as I was expected, at least that far. However, what was wrong? Why were people wrong who were predicting inflation? So my theory is, look at this trough, this valley of average real rates. So in 2022, we will have been facing the conditions when the average real rates have been severely negative over average over the course of 2 years. That provides tremendous stimulus to the economy. And it is very inflationary because real rates, negative real rates, make people do things like accumulate inventories, expanding their balance sheets, creating money, which creates more money in the system and thus continues to devalue money. In 2022, we had peak inflation and incidentally, we had a peak impact of cumulative negative real rates. That impact started to diminish in 2023 as inflation started to go down and interest rates continued to go up. However, that weight of negative real rates in the past 2 years was still very heavy in 2023. And as you see, the blue line and the green line are just about to cross. There is nothing magical about real rates being zero, but I'm just pointing out that we're approaching the point when the negative, when the real rates will have been roughly zero on average over the last 2 years. We are not in some kind of restrictive federal rate bonanza right now yet. Now, as we keep going, and as we will continue to keep going, this thing will start being more and more a cumulative restrictive impact. And that's why I believe that we don't know yet what will be the effects of this. I think they will probably, the effects will probably start biting at some point at employment. And that will at some point diminish wage pressure, or possibly there will be weaker stock market. And I'll go the next slides to discussion of stock markets. And all I want to emphasize is that I feel that like anybody who says the economy has withstood the rise in interest rates irresponsibly and prematurely. But to say that we're falling off the cliff, recession is inevitable next month, everything is falling apart, is also to me a little premature and overly bold. So right now I advertise being agnostic, but it is possible that the fiscal impulse will overcome everything else. The fiscal impulse and various structural problem will overcome real rates. However, my experience shows that usually it's the rates that overcome everything else. Because if the US government will keep expanding a deficit while keeping real rates high, all it will do is just drive the dollar higher. If you keep issuing treasury bonds, putting more and more treasury bonds out there, eventually foreigners will have to buy them. And to buy them, they'll have to buy dollars. And that will just drive capital account surplus. So we're going to need to make this capital account surplus happen. We're going to have to run high and high current account deficit, which can be achieved through high and high dollar. So it's almost like unstoppable trap. If you keep running a fiscal deficit but not accommodated, and if you keep running stimulative fiscal policy and tight monetary policy, you're going to have your currency keep running higher. And that is something to consider, for example, what's going to happen if I'm wrong and rates will stay higher for prolonged period of time. So what I would like to do is to, one might think is like, is it really true? Why do I have this 2-year lag of the cycles? How does it affect stock market? Why rates dominate so much? I'm going to show you the next slide, just briefly. It's a slide of the relationship between lagged interest rate momentum and forward stock momentum. I've done this chart many times, including on this show. Eric, I don't know if you remember it, but what I've noticed is that if you, one of the best predictors of how stock market does over the next 2 years is to look how has the bond market done over past 2 years. So the orange line is the how stock market will do 2 years from now. And notice, like the shaded area, we still don't know how it will do. We have to go back to 2022 to know how the stock market will have done. But bond market, we'll look back and say, what is the difference between 10-year yield today and 10-year yield 2 years ago? And if it's gone up, that's bad for stock market. If it's gone down, that's good for stock market. As you see, the fit, at least since the 90s, has been extremely good. I will admit, as cherry pick, the fit was not so good before. We were in a different environment, and one could argue the environment changed. That's a long discussion. One of the things you can notice that recently there was a crossover between those things, and like recently kind of the blue line projected immediate crash, and instead stock market in March, and instead stock market was going up. Now there are some very weird conditions here, because when you look at the blue line, we're going back actually 4 years, because we're looking how stock market was predicted 2 years ago, which meant 2022, look back 2 years to 2020, which means that we were looking at March 2020. And of course, between March 2020 and March 2022, interest rates have gone up tremendously, which would predict bad performance of stock market from 2022 to 2024, which was not at all the case. Now, as you see, the chart does conform really well, but it also doesn't conform perfectly, and there are like pretty big gaps and lags. It's like on a big picture, it's really good, but on a small picture, all sorts of things can happen. But already a few months ago, we realized that that will have been a problem because there is such a particular idiosyncratic moment. This 2-year lag is not meant to be. There is no law of physics saying 2 years. You have to go back specifically 2 years. It's just a best horizon we kind of empirically could find, right? But we realized that there is a difference, and that's why even in the past, people challenged the chart of ours, and now we kind of found more reasons to think of the challenge with this chart is that what we really should be looking at is real rates, not just nominal rates. Because in the past, when inflation was stable, it is sufficient to look at nominal rates to really understand interest rate impact. It was that simple. If interest rates are higher, that means we have tighter monetary policy, if inflation is relatively stable. But if we change the equation and say, well, what if inflation is not really that stable? Then we come to think, well, maybe it is really not nominal rates, but the real rate matter in terms of defining whether interest rates are headwind or tailwind to the economy. So we started to chart it in real rates. And going to the next slide, the last slide of my show, you can see the same chart, but shown in real rates. As you see, the recent beginning of wobbliness in the stock market over the last few weeks was actually kind of almost concurrent with a corresponding move in the real rates, because the real rates did not really come down in March 2020. They were very high in March 2020 because of high deflationary impact. They only started to go seriously negative only later. And that's why that negative momentum actually is not starting from late in 2020. Correspondingly, now we should see the weakness in stock market. If we took this 2-year lag as a complete like law of physics, which I'm very skeptical of doing so. So when I present this chart, I have this general warning to the investors. Be very careful of people who say, oh, I had this chart, it does not work anymore. Let me show you the other chart. That chart will work because it's very easy to game it. You cannot just, it's too easy to backfeed. You can always, like, that's what I've seen, by the way, over the last 2 years, invariably, like, people had so many arguments for rates going high and so many arguments for rates going lower and so many charts proving one thing or another. And something kind of in between, I would say, happened so far. Or some people who argue that rates would go to 8% so far have not been correct. People who predicted like recession or rates rapidly going back to zero by 2024 obviously were wrong. But there were so many charts confirming either of those. So be careful of people substituting charts. So I am substituting chart here. I'm not doing it post factum. We already knew that we're probably going to need to look at this other chart, but take it like for what it's worth with a grain of salt. So what I'm seeing is a good fit, but also the interesting thing you see is that people look at the orange line and the blue line over the last couple of years. So right before the shaded area, as you see, orange line is below the blue line. What does it is interesting tell you? It tells you that stock market, in fact, underperformed. So many people were talking about stock market performing great. Why is stock market going up so much? Why is stock market defying, gravity defying? But this came actually as a very recent realization for me looking at this chart. Given how stimulative the real rates have been, and I'm looking just at real rates, not even looking at the fiscal policy, just at this one thing, how stimulative real rates have been, stock market should have done even better. It was generally until very recently, until last like couple of months, it's been really underperforming. And that's a very paradox, like a statement that it comes under surprise, because by everyone else, like, well, not everyone else, but there is the view that stock market has performed, surprised everybody with its strong performance, has been prevalent. But I'm actually looking at it saying, you know what, stock markets should have surprised it. That's with its weak performance, given that we were running negative 8% real rates. So for a while. And now this has rectified, as you see, if you learn the real rates, as real rates are beginning to actually show their increase, right? And the blue line is beginning to go down and accelerating down, and the orange line is keep going up. Now stock market is in overperformance zone, but it is beginning to be slightly dragged down by the blue line. I believe we can very easily see outperformance of stock market. It doesn't have to go all the way down to blue line, which would indicate like 40% correction from the level lows of 2022. But I believe that it will start being more likely than not, will be start dragging down, at least to some extent. And we will not see really good performance of stock market over the next year or two. So that's my base case.
Alex, let's go back to page 3 in the slide deck showing average real interest rates. During the course of calendar year 2023, we saw an increase from -6% to 0. So that's a 600 basis point increase in real interest rates. Now, historically, the strongest driver of precious metals has been real interest rates. So you would expect with a 600 basis point increase from -6 to 0, that would crash precious metals prices. Gold would be, you know, $800 an ounce or something. It's the opposite. We've seen gold go through the roof, and at the same time, gold's correlation to the U.S. dollar has broken down from its usual inverse correlation. What's going on with real rates and the dollar and gold? Maybe you can break down all three of those things and the interrelationships between them and why the correlations seem to have changed during the course of 2023.
Okay, yeah, that's a very legitimate question. And I have to say, I've been asking questions myself around that. Gold could be viewed as a currency and obviously has correlation, what I call tautological correlation. When dollar goes up, chances are all other assets, whether it's euro, dollar will go down in terms of, euro, gold will go down in terms of dollar and converse, right? We don't know that specifically, but the likelihood is if all we know that dollar gets stronger, likely all other currencies will go weaker, and that could apply to gold as well. Now, gold is also not like other currencies. And let me talk about gold and precious metals first, and then I'll go to overall currency situation, if you don't mind. I'll start with gold. One of the things that I've observed over time, while there's been this very strong talk and very strong perception that gold should go down if real rates go high and converse, that actually has not necessarily been historically the case. By the way, that's not even historically the case with the dollar itself. One of some of the mistakes I made, for example, in the cycle of 2021 that I was comparing to the cycle of 2004, 2007. And in that cycle, real rates kept climbing up as Fed kept raising steadily rates all the way from like 1% to 5.25%, right? And at a steady, not as high pace, but it's been a process. And during all this time, dollar has been weak and gold has been very strong. So that in itself did not derail. Conversely, in 2001 and 2002, when the interest rates were very low, dollar was weak, precious metals, other precious metals like palladium were like basically given away for free. Basically, people were coming to you on the street and saying, do you want to hold some palladium? You could have gotten palladium for $200 an ounce, which in my opinion back then was free. I took as much as I could for JP Morgan, but there was a limit to how much I could take, right? But so it's not like so obvious. And we can talk about reasons about this. All I want to say that it's not so obvious that overall dollar and gold correlate just directly so strongly to real rates. But also it is important to understand that gold is not other currencies, and there are a lot of things going on with gold. Gold is an asset which has buyers and sellers. If there's more buyers than sellers, it's going to go up. I don't know who was the recent buyer of gold. It could have been central banks. It could have been some people panicked about geopolitical crises. But I think all of the things have been said. But one thing that have not been very much in public discussion, just this morning, I was actually going over some numbers from number crunches of four gold mining companies. And you know what? Their profits are not that great. Like this recent wave of inflation actually took a bite out of their margins because the cost of producing gold of mining gold have gone up dramatically. And I don't know if people are noticing this fact that the mining costs have gone up dramatically.
Well, I've certainly noticed that the mining shares are not going up dramatically as the precious metal goes up.
Yeah, but why? I mean, I tried to dig into this and I noticed that actually mining costs have various labor issues and other like political problems around mining. Mining costs have gone up quite a bit. I think they're creating floor for mining new precious metals. So I don't know if that's a factor, but I'm just putting it out there. I don't know if it's a decisive factor. I'm just want to add it to the, like, this is not, has nothing to do with like when sovereign currency goes up and down, there's no such thing as mining cost, right? But when you have gold or silver, there is actually, it's a real expense to get them above ground. And paradoxically, margins are not that high, even at gold 2000. Now with gold 2400, they're going to go higher. I think mining stocks might have space to run up, but they are not as high as you would think. Let's put it like this.
So essentially, you're making the tail wags the dog argument that everybody thinks gold prices are extremely high right now, but you're making the opposite argument that when you consider what it will take to incentivize building more gold mines in order to increase production capacity, no, actually, even at these gold prices, it's not enough to incentivize building a whole bunch of more gold mines because, as you say, the cost of mining has gone up so much that even at these gold prices, those gold mining shares are really not that profitable.
I'm putting out that could be at least partially the case. Now, one could also make an argument, you know what, it almost does not matter because nobody needs above ground gold anyway. It's all about the dynamics, who wants to buy it, who wants to sell it. I think it's a two-way thing. New supply matters, stock matters, and flow matters. So the flow probably is not going to be so great for gold in terms of like new supply, but the stock is high, and if central banks decide to sell, it's going to go down. If central banks decide to buy, it's going to go up. For me, the interesting thing about the gold and silver and platinum trades are that I'm just looking at historical charts, and they look pretty good on historical charts, on like multi-decade charts. Silver has been much higher. Platinum has been much higher. Gold has not been higher, but gold miners have been much higher. Like everything looks like next cycle, we can have high as much. Nothing really stops us from $60 silver, $3,000 platinum, $3,000 gold, which basically tells you that I see much more upside in platinum and silver than gold. But I don't see any reasons why any of those things cannot happen, which creates just a good risk reward. But unlike, I think, other players, I cannot claim mathematically solve the equation what the price for any of those things should be. And I don't have like a single view. This is what they're going to do. All I'm saying that like, even at these levels, even after the recent slightly more expensive levels, there is still upside looks pretty good relative to downside probabilistically. And I think like those things are pretty hard to understand what's going on in those metals. And you just have to look at long-term charts and see where they can go and be patient enough. And then they usually go where they should go sooner or later. That's my experience with both precious metals and digital assets, any hard assets.
Alex, let's come back to currencies. What were you going to say there?
Well, I think with currencies, situation is somewhat different. We're seeing real, I mean, again, on the surface of that, without being devil's advocate, looking at the top-down data, we're seeing real divergence. U.S. data is just really strong, and U.S. rates are beginning to diverge on the high side from European rates, from Chinese rates, and many other countries. And it created a strong tailwind for the dollar. And I feel like there is no particular way to get out of it, of this tailwind, without Fed dramatically changing policy. And it seems to me that whether I'm right or whether I'm wrong, the policy will not be changed prematurely. There is two possibilities. Either I'm wrong and inflation will stay higher, go higher, in which case I think Fed is well prepared for that and they will not lower rates prematurely, even if possible. Some people argue might even start raising rates again. But I think that's what they will do. They will not be obstinate in the face of rising inflation and say that we will have to cut rates anyway. And by the way, I don't believe that election cycle will affect them in any way. If anything, it'll make them more hawkish so they don't appear to be swayed by election cycle. That's in shorthand my view of that. However, if I am right, and in fact, we will start trending towards deflation in the next few months, they probably will be behind the curve because as those things, especially if it's a recessionary deflation, those things develop very fast and Fed is never ahead of that. They're always behind that wave. So in either case, not really hope for particularly stimulative policy. I think the hope for stimulative policy any time in 2024, early 2025 is close to zero. Because even if they cut rates, their policy will not be stimulative because they will cut rates because they already have to, kind of a little behind the curve, which means the dollar will remain attractive. And I think that the carry arguments and just, I just don't know how they're going to get out of all this situation. Dollar will remain attractive. And they're continuing to unwind the balance sheets with more treasuries out there. The treasuries have high yields. People will be buying them and buying dollar with them and not hedge the dollar potentially. So I don't know how they're planning to deal with how you could stop capital account surplus and stronger currency. And I think in this way, like, for example, China continuing to be interesting. I think there are a lot of people posting about imminent catastrophic devaluation of RMB. I don't see catastrophic devaluation because China is totally in control of its currency. They have ample reserves and current account surplus and MCF reserves. Now, ample reserves, they don't need to. Like, you cannot run them out of dollars. I think that's a ridiculous idea. But they seem to be comfortable with the sliding depreciation, which is pretty nice if you have positive carry and sliding appreciation. I think the most radical thing that can happen in China at some point, they will embrace something like Abenomics and just opt for faster depreciation. But that's not a central scenario for immediate future. So far, we just have to watch the grind. But we're having other currencies grind. Like, for example, look at Swiss franc. It has been very strong up to a few months ago. They eventually cleanly diverged the policy. They already cut rates, and it seems like they might do more rate cuts. I think the really strong franc has been taking a bite for Swiss, and they don't like it anymore. And I think they're on the path of depreciating their currency. So I think if you stay with rates high, you beginning to see interesting currency opportunities, especially if you imagine that US will not cut rates this year. I think long dollar versus other currencies is a good trade.
Alex, I want to go back to something you said earlier in the interview, which is that although you've got a certain outlook, you said another 6 months, 12 months, if things don't change, you're going to have to revisit that view. Now, I know from reading your book that you're a very disciplined investor. You're used to thinking about how to hedge trades so that if it turns out that you are wrong about something, you're covered. So what can you tell our listeners about either hedging strategies or how you approach this question of what if it turns out that your outlook in terms of disinflation to deflation turns out not to be correct?
Yes, I like to think about this that you have to be very clear about what your trade is. So you can very clearly say afterwards if I was right or wrong. And there are two types of trades. Like, for example, let's think about buying a stock. You can buy stock at $100 and say, I will take profits at $150 and cut losses at $80. Whenever that happens, so you hold it till one of those things happen, and then you'll know whether you're right or wrong. You're not right when the stock is 110. You're not wrong when stock is 96. You're wrong when it's at 80, and you're right is 150, right? Or you can say, I will buy the stock and hold it for 2 years. And then if it's up, and then I'm going to sell it in 2 years, good, bad, or ugly. So if it was up, I'm right. I was right. If I sold that, I'm wrong. I think there is a lot of this drift that happens when people are like, something goes up, then it goes down, and somebody tells them they're wrong, and they say like, yeah, no, but it was 10% up back then, right? It's like a little bit like with oil. We had this conversation, was it right or wrong to hold front oil? There are so many times you could have said that you were right, and so many times you could have said you were wrong over the last year. But in the end, you just have to define what are your trades are, what are your profits and stop losses. So that's the first way to think about this. So sometimes you can think in terms of just, okay, this is the trade, this is the money capital I'm committing, this is the risk I'm taking, and if I'm wrong, I'll just lose a certain amount of money and reconsider. Now, I like to build a portfolio of trades which are all positive expectations but cover various kind of sectors of economic outcome. And sometimes it does not work. Like, for example, in 21 and 22, I didn't have a very balanced portfolio and I had a lot of headwind. In 2023, I actually it worked for me because, yes, interest rates did not go down in 2023, but I made money on other trades and it was kind of ended up being okay. I was ended up to navigate that. But that's the aspiration is to being able to navigate any environment. And the thing is, like, if I think it's almost like intellectually demands me, if I say, oh, I think rates should be lower, then you could ask your question, well, what if they're high? What will break down? What kind of problems you see? So one argument you can make, oh, if rates are going to stay really high or go up, then stock market has to go down. So maybe you want to buy puts on stock market. And if you think rates are going to stay high, opt to protect yourself against rates staying high and inflation going higher. Or maybe you can say dollar is going to go higher, so you buy dollar. I was fortunate that there are some structured trades which are very particular in interest rate curve, like having to do with like municipal bonds, extensions, and stuff like this, which worked really well in high real rate environments. So there were some opportunities to put in some trades that were probably wouldn't have lost much money if rates are lower, but do really well when rates are higher. If you can find those, my advice is to other managers, exercise your creativity in finding what it is that you think will is not priced right if you imagine rates staying here or being higher. I already gave you a couple examples. I don't think China will be able to maintain the forwards on their currency in the sense that for you to lose money on being long dollar China because the carry is positive now, dollar China would have to appreciate. I think it's hard for it to appreciate with in the environment of such economic divergence and high rates in US. So that's one thing to look at. And another stock market is another example. I think it's hard for stock market to keep going up if rates will continue to stay high or, as some people think, go higher.
Finally, I want to ask you about energy markets, which I know, just like myself, you think about quite a bit. How do you see the balance of supply and demand working out, and what are going to be the primary factors in coming years?
Here, when I talk about this, I just want to premises with the fact that I probably will go a little bit on a layperson speculation. So I want to, for a second, take off my macro trader hat and put on my science fiction writer hat. So because what's happening in the world are some very dramatic changes. Changes which only recently lay in the realm of science fiction. But I think by now to deny what is happening in the area of computation or artificial intelligence, honestly, I no longer take seriously people who deny singularity and deny the fact that there is an AI revolution going on. The amount of data that needs to be stored, the amount of computation that needs to be performed is not rising exponentially. It's rising along completely different curves, curves which are not even imaginable in the real physical universe. So clearly this demand will soon not be met. The energy demand, right now, still computation is some small portion of the world energy demand. I think it will totally overwhelm everything else within our lifetimes, if we're lucky. Possibly within a decade or two decades. And the changes of the world will see us so different. So that puts like a lot of pressures on the energy because we're in the process of energy transition, but with even if we have a slowdown in the global economy, it might temporarily slow down energy demand, but to see it's coming off entirely is hard to imagine. So hence, I kind of still want to be somewhat on fossil fuels, but going forward, neither fossil fuels, no wind power, no solar power, none of it will solve. Now, you and I have been arguing about fusion or fission. Honestly, I think fission will be not enough, no matter how much we have it. I don't know if fusion will be enough eventually. Again, putting on my science fiction hat, there will be a time when the demand of computation will rise so much that nothing we have will be enough, and that will be the constraining factor for how we can develop artificial intelligence. So I think this is just, for me, that is like the framing of what I'm looking right now at shifts in the energy market. On one part, there is no immediate crisis. We still have enough fuel to go. And on another part, some dramatic shift going on forward.
Well, I agree with you, Alex, and I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out, and also very, very difficult to predict, because people like you and I can look at this problem and say, okay, clearly we've got to get off of fossil fuels, particularly coal, which is the worst polluter, and we've got to move from the age of oil and fossil fuels into the age of nuclear. But even a country like Germany, which is famous for having smart people that understand engineering and science, has shut down perfectly good nuclear plants in order to build more brand new coal-fired power plants. So this has become so much more political than it's based on logic and reason. And that, to me, means it's going to be impossible to predict what happens next. Any thoughts there?
Almost every view I've expressed or keep expressing, the risk is political, because political currents are so hard to predict. My only kind of, again, even further science fiction hat, we're creating artificial intelligence, very smart. Soon it will be transcendent in our terms, and it needs to eat. Imagine a bunch of transcendent beings which are very hungry, and what they eat is energy. I almost feel like artificial intelligence will find a way to game the whole political, and the world seem to get itself the energy it needs.
Well, Alex, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell our listeners a little bit more about what you do at Hante Investors, and for our institutional and accredited investor audience, how they can contact you for a tear sheet or information on your fund.
So the best way to contact me is to go to the website of my company, HonteInv.com, Honte, like Honte Investments, HonteInv.com, and you'll see some general information, a lot of publicly available appearances. And if you are a qualified purchaser, you can fill out the questionnaire and get fund information. People also can follow me on X at agorevich23.
Patrick Serezna, Nick Karlonik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, it was great to have Alex back on the show. Now joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Alex's picture saying, looking for the downloads. Now, Eric, let's dive into crude oil, starting with the EIA inventory.
EIA printed a massive drawdown of 6.4 million barrels, Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 659,000 barrels, gasoline drawing down 634,000 barrels. The lone build on the board was distillates at plus 1.6 million barrels for a net petroleum drawdown of 5.4 million barrels, with U.S. production holding unchanged at 13.1 million barrels. Crude oil is consolidating as everyone wonders whether geopolitical escalation between Israel and Iran is already over or if it's only just begun. In my opinion, Israel wants to escalate and wants to escalate very badly. So what happens next depends primarily on the extent to which Biden is willing to support and effectively to allow that escalation from Israel. My sense is that Biden has already decided that he wants to wait until after the U.S. election before the United States starts a war with Iran. And he's probably made a deal with Benjamin Netanyahu already saying, look, just hold your pants and until we get to the election. After that, we'll let you do anything you want. But it remains to be seen what happens between now and the election and whether or not we can get there before some escalation happens on its own.
Eric, the much-anticipated consolidation has finally happened. Obviously, geopolitics with a huge overhang is going to put a floor under oil. And so now that we've consolidated down to the 50-day moving average, it's a very interesting place to be watching whether or not oil establishes a short-term swing low that can bottom dip. Generally, I think that if oil can stay on a sustained basis north of $80, that this is the kind of a pullback that should be bought. And I don't see any reason why we can't see oil get back up toward the highs from last year in the mid-90s as we move forward. Nonetheless, let's move on to equities. I want to get Nick involved in the conversation. Nick, what levels are you watching here on the S&P?
Yeah, Patrick. So right now, the SPX spot price is approximately 50.40. We have an implied move for the May 17th monthly OPEX of plus minus 140 points. Therefore, the upper implied move is 51.80, and the lower implied move is 4,900. Right now, we have key resistance at 5,100 and key support at 5,000. As I mentioned in prior weeks, I'm inclined to think we see a test of the previous all-time highs from January of 2022 around that 48.20 mark on SPX. So I do think we have some downside left in the short term. Although I am bullish on certain names, I'm being cautiously optimistic right now.
Yeah, what I find interesting, on page four, I put the chart of the S&P 500 with the 50-day moving average on there. And what's interesting is that it's been a very good arbiter of trend, which is that when on a sustained basis, it's above the 50-day moving average, it's a clear bull trend. And the turning below the 50-day moving average has obviously marked many of the corrective phases. We, very similar to all the downturns through 2022 and 23 that are visible on this chart, some sort of multi-month corrections often happen in this state. With the fact that we've rallied up towards this 50-day moving average and rejected it. And obviously, earnings were going to play a huge role. The corrective or downside window is still open. And 4,800 and 4,700 are all realistic downside targets that would put this into that 10% market correction category. It's really about next week. I mean, not only do we have the pig in the python moment of all the corporate earnings, and I think that Mag 7s are going to play an important role in deciding the short-term trend, but we also have the FOMC meeting and the jobs numbers. And so plenty of news that could drive volatility in both directions. And so it will be a bumpy ride, but the downside window still remains open for the short-term correction. Let's move on to the NASDAQ. What are you watching on the Qs?
Yeah, so right now in Qs, the spot price is approximately 422. We have an implied move for the May 17th monthly OPEX of plus minus 16 points. Therefore, we have an upper implied move of 438 and a lower implied move of 406. Right now, we have key resistance at 435 and key support at around 413. I'm inclined to think we see a move lower toward that 400 level, which would mark a top-to-bottom move of around 11%. As you mentioned, the Mag 7 are going to be the ones to kind of dictate where we move. We saw Tesla miss on the top and bottom. However, they actually popped on earnings. And we saw Meta last night report higher expected CapEx for next year, as well as lowered guidance, which caused them to fall about 15% overall. So right now I'm being cautious, but I'm holding Apple and Google in my own portfolio. And I'm waiting to see what happens with the other big names, because I do think we test that 400 mark out in the short term.
All right, Nick, let's move on to the volatility index, because Friday's OPEX drop that we had that caused a little bit of fear to come into the market saw the VIX pop into the 20 handle on the short term. That solidified at least a swing low that spurred the rally of the last few days. And we really now seen the VIX come right back down off of that high. But it really does feel like we've now entered a new higher volatility state in the market, the 12 to 15 range that has more or less contained the volatility index throughout the last 4 or 5 months has now been decisively broken. It'll be really interesting to see whether or not we get back up into the 20s during this market correction on a sustained basis. What are you watching there on the VIX?
Yeah, Patrick. So with the VIX at around 16, we can expect intraday top-to-bottom moves on SPX of about 1%. What we're seeing now is that volatility is no longer cheap, insurance is no longer cheap, and market participants are now chasing that premium. I think we're going to see perhaps another pop toward that 20 mark, which we saw last week. The highest level we saw was 19, which was the highest we've seen volatility spike since last November for all. So it's been a few months since volatility has been that high. Overall, I'd be cautious in terms of remaining long in the market on short-term positions. And if you are long in your portfolios, insurance is not a bad idea overall right here.
Well, you know, the one thing to take away is that during market corrections, overall volatility in both directions always accelerates. And so, you know, getting used to the idea of 57 to 70 S&P point swings on a day in, day out basis is actually quite normal. And you know, it's almost like climatizing to that higher volatility.
Absolutely. I agree. And moving on to the dollar index on page 7, Eric, what are your thoughts here?
The most important news for the dollar this week was completely ignored by markets. That news was the U.S. House of Representatives vote in favor of the extrajudicial payment of seized Russian foreign reserve assets to Ukraine, which Senator Rand Paul correctly characterized as an act of war. It's important to separate whatever views you may have about Russia from the question of whether or not the United States will remain credible in the eyes of other nations' central banks as a custodian of central bank reserve assets. The United States just completely abandoned the rule of law and made an extrajudicial political decision to award one nation's foreign reserve assets to that nation's enemy. This plays perfectly into Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping's longer-term agendas perfectly and will only help both of them to persuade other nations around the world to abandon the U.S. dollar as the world's global reserve currency. The consequences of loss of reserve currency status for the U.S. government's ability to continue its pattern of deficit spending cannot be overstated, and almost nobody seems to be paying attention to these consequences. This is a profoundly bearish sign for the U.S. dollar in the long term and will ultimately accelerate the schedule for Luke Gromans' predictions of the U.S. dollar losing its reserve currency status coming to fruition. But for now, U.S. financial markets are completely ignoring this important long-term fundamental signal. What the market is responding to is collapsing expectations of a campaign of several rate cuts later this year and increasing expectations of the possibility of further rate hikes if inflation continues to run hot. So if Jim Bianco is proven right that inflation has already bottomed, I see plenty of room for the Dixie to move considerably higher in the near term for all the reasons our friend Brent Johnson has predicted before other nations eventually take decisive action to ditch the dollar as reserve currency, which will ultimately prove to be ultra bearish for the dollar, but not yet. But just as Brent has said himself many times before, I think the U.S. dollar is much more likely to move higher for now. The true consequences of the U.S. government's abdication of the rule of law won't be felt for some time to come.
Yeah, Eric, it really does feel like the U.S. dollar index has entered some sort of a new bull phase, but it does have a couple of key obstacles here that may on the short term, have the dollar bumping its head along some resistance. Now, not only are we approached the 2023 highs around the 107 level, but one of the key currencies that the U.S. dollar has been strengthening against has been the U.S. dollar yen, and I have that on page 8. And our techniques, the measured moves are complete. And with us going into the Bank of Japan meeting, it'll be interesting to see whether or not we see a correction start in the U.S. dollar against that yen after such an extraordinary move. And so maybe on the short term, the dollar may be far more volatile without any directional trend, but I still think it resolves itself bullishly. I'll be watching whether that 107 level can be beaten.
Moving on to page 9, we have that gold futures chart, which is off highs right now. What are you guys thinking here?
The big correction in gold was easy to see coming and resulted from the non-re-escalation of geopolitical conflict between Israel and Iran. My prediction is that the U.S. will eventually enter this conflict in a direct hot war conflict with Iran, but that President Biden will do everything humanly possible to delay that outcome until after the November elections. The House of Representatives' reckless extrajudicial seizure of one nation's reserve assets and giving them to their enemy will ultimately be extremely bullish for gold because it will incentivize other central banks around the world to accelerate the pace of their gold buying in preparation for abandoning the dollar as global reserve currency. But for now, geopolitical conflict premium and whether the Fed resumes a rate hiking cycle are likely to be the primary short-term determinants of gold's price action. This correction could easily go another $100 to the downside if rate hikes are back on the table and tensions between Israel and Iran can be kept on hold until after the election. Or we could see the exact opposite and go back to new all-time highs overnight if the U.S. enters a direct military conflict with Iran. I remain confident that the long-term bull market in gold still has a lot farther to go to the upside. The question is only of how deep of a correction we'll see before it's time to buy the dip, and there's plenty of room for news flow to push the market hard in one direction or the other.
Well, Eric, I totally get the case for the bigger picture gold bull market being underway. But to me, I'm just looking at it purely technically. And on the short term, this has been one of the most extraordinary bull impulses that gold has had in a long time, in many years. And the question really is, can the bulls maintain this momentum? And one of the big tells is about how deep and how far a market corrections go. A full Fibonacci retracement of this bull advance could see us trading down to that 50-day moving average around 2250 or 2200. But if the bulls are decisively in control of this trend, then the correction should be very shallow and very well defended. And so if the price action can decisively stay north of 2300 here in the coming week or more, especially once we get through all of that news next week, that actually may make a case for another immediate bull leg higher, which could see 2,500 on the upside.
Moving on to our final slide of page 10, we have that uranium chart. Eric, I'm always interested in hearing your thoughts.
There's been a whole new round of political rhetoric from the White House about the need to break our dependence on Russian uranium imports. I think this talk from the White House is a likely catalyst for the passage of the Senate bill already pending that would ban Russian uranium imports. When that bill passes in the Senate, it's likely to be a strong bullish catalyst for both uranium and uranium miners. But for now, the market is still consolidating, with almost no price movement in uranium itself until yesterday when we were down 3%, and still plenty of opportunity to buy many of the best uranium mining shares just above their lows from over a month ago when the correction may have bottomed, or who knows, maybe we still have one more leg lower. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, the bull case for uranium is still very strong, but the price action on the short term is continuing to show some consolidation. Every time the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust tries to rally, the spot uranium simply doesn't react and the selling comes right back in. It's a very heavy chart on the very short term, and there could certainly be one more corrective leg that could see a 5 to 10% drop in uranium on the pullback. But it certainly, in my mind, will be an extraordinary buy on dip if it does give that kind of a pullback. Right now, we're in some sort of a corrective phase. It may be over soon, and it will be very likely a great buying opportunity. But right now, in the short term, a bull breakout is not yet really started.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the slide deck that Alex provided, including the chart book we just discussed here in the postgame, and included a number of links to articles that we found interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That is Eric spelled with a K. And follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.